Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Joe Mazzalotti. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason.
Pleasure thanks to be for here. Being here. Would you like to tell us about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I am an independent Rails and iOS developer. I run Mugshotbot, which we'll talk about a little bit during this show. And I consider myself the only turbo developer in the world right now.
The only turbo developer in the world? What do you mean?
Basecamp's, you know, new Hotwire Turbo framework that they're releasing has some native components for iOS and Android, and I've only seen me doing it for other companies, so I've been helping out a bunch of companies build their native iOS apps using Turbo.
Oh, I see. And can you tell us a little bit about, like, how that works? Because I'm a little familiar with Hotwire and Turbo and all that stuff. But I haven't, like, gotten into it yet, and I certainly have no idea how the iOS component of it works.
Definitely. So back in TurboLinks world, which I feel like kind of instills fear in Rails developers, TurboLinks, back when you had, you know, jQuery was all around, TurboLinks essentially would hijack a, you know, link click and make an XHR request via JavaScript and then just, like, shove the body back into the DOM. It wouldn't refresh the whole page, which sped things up dramatically. There was a lot of downsides to that, or things you had to work around, like your onload events with JavaScript didn't fire exactly as you, you know, had hoped. So Turbo takes that to the next level and provides these hooks that every time a link is clicked, it fires these special JavaScript events that then can propagate to the Turbo native wrapper SDK or framework, whatever you call it. Then you're free to do native looking things like, you know, sliding screens onto the stack or pushing modals and making your hybrid app feel, you know, really native on the platform you're working with.
Okay. Yeah. And there have been other attempts in the past to, like, oh, I remember this thing called Ruby Motion. And I've never done, like, any iOS development really, other than, like, a tiny little bit of almost nothing. So I don't know anything about this stuff, but I remember Ruby Motion, and that was, like, it kind of worked, but it wasn't really all that great because it wasn't sufficiently close to the native iOS experience. But I assume this Turbo method of development probably gets a lot closer, or else people wouldn't be accepting it as a solution.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. The Ruby Motion, like these hybrid frameworks that still exist, Xamarin, you know, whatever. They either wrap native SDKs or something like Dart is just generating code under the hood, or like React Native, right? The difference with Turbo is that you still serve your web content in the app. So you're actually just looking at your mobile web view, but you're decorating it with, you know, a native tab bar or a native navigation stack or a native map or what have you. And all of that native stuff is written in Swift or in Kotlin or in Java, you know, for Android. And you don't have to worry about learning a new language. You just are essentially saying, here's where the hybrid content lives, and I'm going to write all the native stuff that matters in the native language of choice. So it's a little bit different, like, you know, mentality than previous hybrid frameworks would have, where they kind of take over everything.
Got it. Okay. Well, I think that's about all the questions about that I will ask, because like we're quickly getting out of my depth and I won't be able to ask any more questions that are actually smart questions. I have another question for you just out of curiosity. I personally have a full-time job. I have for like the last 2.5 years, but before that I was a freelancer for like 8 years on and off. How long have you been freelancing?
I have been freelancing for probably close to 6 years now. And I've gone full-time about a year and a half. So like January 2020, left a startup where we were like really small, like only 6 people. And now I'm doing it full-time. So I do, you know, Ruby on Rails dev, iOS dev, a lot of this Turbo dev for clients. And then also this mentor and coaching approach where we hop on like Tuple and pair program for a few hours together, which has been really fun. I've met a lot of cool people that way.
Okay. So before you went full-time, you were just doing like nights and weekends freelancing kind of stuff?
Exactly. Yeah. I had a client or two that was looking to make a iOS app from their Rails code base. So I was doing TurboLinks apps for them. Kind of got me started with the whole thing, and then was able to bring that to my full-time job at the startup. And now it's a big part of my, like, you know, my sweet spot, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
And when did you have a desire to like go full time with the freelancing?
When I was let go.
Oh, okay. That's happened to me too.
Yeah. So the company I worked at, amazing company, like really tiny, just couldn't hack it with, you know, 6 people. So they actually like let go 2 of us or whatever the number was. I was one of them. I was the only developer at the time, and the CTO is technical. The founder is technical, so he's doing all the dev now. But, you know, they're like super lean, just like scraping to get by. But it gave me an opportunity to think about, like, what do I want in the future? Do I want to continue this freelance thing more full-time, or just go back in the, you know, jump in the ring and go to another full-time company? And my wife has been freelancing for, I think she had been doing it for like 2 years already at that point, 2.5 years, and encouraged me to like research it and check it out. She does content marketing and strategy. And I was like, okay, this is actually really cool. Like I can work on the stuff that I want to work on, like my side projects, like MugshotBot, like my other iOS apps, and also do this really cool high value work for multiple of clients instead of just working for a single company. And it all kind of clicked together, and I was like, oh, this is really fun. Like I can do what I want, you know, most of the day, every single day. And I was like, okay, this is good. I'm keeping with this. And it's really been a blast. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I had an interesting freelancing experience because at the beginning for me, so this was like the summer of 2011, I got, you know, I could say that I got fired from the place that I was working at. It's not really quite that exactly. It was like, we're working on a project and the project didn't really make that much sense for the business to do. And we kind of slowly realized that it wasn't going to work out. And so we parted ways. And when that happened, I was already kind of dissatisfied with jobs in general. And so I'm like, okay, well, rather than like go get another job that I'm probably going to hate, I'm going to just start freelancing at this point. Mm-hmm. And I had this idea. I had kind of a series of delusions over the following 8 years. My first delusion was that like I would have this much improved lifestyle where I would have a lot more time, freedom, and stuff like that. But what I realized is that if you want to actually make some money that's like comparable to what you'd get at a full-time job, then you have to impose some discipline on yourself and work about as much as you would at a full-time job. And eventually where I came to was, well, here's what I realized. I realized that the vast majority of freelance programmers are just doing what I call staff augmentation or staff aug work, where you're doing hourly coding and you're filling the same slot as all the other full-time developers at the organization, going to all the same meetings as the other developers, doing all the same stuff. And the only difference is that you're getting paid hourly instead of getting paid a salary. And that realization kind of slowly dawned on me over the course of 8 years. Like, some of this stuff that, like, these freelance gurus, and I won't name names, but there's people in the development community who kind of paint this picture of what life can be like as a freelancer. And frankly, it's just not true for the vast majority of developers. And once I realized that, I'm like, oh shit, this thing that I've, like, been striving for years kind of doesn't exist. And so that's when I went back to full-time jobs. And it was kind of funny. I was looking for, it was like 2018, and I was looking for a job. And then this guy found me who needed some work done, and we started a contract relationship. And that actually turned into a full-time job. So my own job search didn't work out, but then this freelancing thing turned into a full-time job. But I'm curious about your experience with freelancing. Is most of your work kind of that hourly coding stuff? And then tell me about your other work that you do, like the coaching stuff, because I've tried to go down that path a little bit myself, and it hasn't always worked out super great for me, but I'm curious about your experience.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you just said. It's really hard, and has been harder for me than I had expected, to break out of, like, the hourly bubble, I like to call it. Because at hourly, you know, all the problems you just described, you're just another developer on the team. And if you want to make comparable salary, you have to work, you know, the 40 whatever hours a week, which isn't something I went into freelancing to do. So I've been trying more and more as my, you know, freelancing career has moved on, to limit the amount of hourly work that I do. And I'm trying to get it down to zero by the end of the year. That's like one of my big goals, is no more hourly work. And everything is project or retainer based. And with project and retainer based work, you can, at least I try to, deliver on value versus time put in. So maybe you're giving that first client a ton of work and a ton of time because you have to build up all your scaffolding and maybe your starter projects or your Rails templates, for example, and to deliver them what they need. But maybe that second client, it's actually a little bit less work because you have some scaffolding built up and you have some tooling built around it, or you already know what you're doing. And then the third one is even less work. But you can still charge that same amount because you're still delivering the same value to that customer, to that client. They don't actually care how much time you spend if they're getting the same quality and of work and, like, delivering on what they need.
Have you actually done that successfully yet?
Yeah. I have a client that I'm working with right now that we did a really big project scope, getting their mobile app up and running. And now we're on a retainer. So they pay me a flat rate per month. And I deliver them, like, we have, like, you know, this never ending to-do list of features that are to be delivered. And I give them what I think is comparable to what they're paying every month in value back to them. And that, you cannot start a client with a retainer. There's no trust built up to be able to just be like, I'm going to charge you this much money and deliver you this many things, you know? So it requires a little bit of a project and over delivering on the project to get to the point where you can say, okay, now I have a retainer with you. Now we are on the same page. We're not trying to nickel and dime each other. I'm going to work as hard as I can. You're going to get as much value as you can. And everyone's going to be happy on the price and the deliverables. And that, I feel, has been really, really nice and a really good sweet spot for me.
Okay. Well, I hope you don't mind me asking what might be some annoying questions, but if you do, like, a retainer where you're paid a flat amount per month, and then you do, a reasonable amount of work each month, isn't that pretty much like buying a block of hours each month? And it's hourly coding, but just with a little bit of a different arrangement?
It definitely can be looked at that way. And I think that that's actually the hardest part of creating a contract for a retainer, is how do I make this not just, this takes this many hours, this takes this many hours, and it's my hourly rate, multiply those two numbers and get my, you know, the value or the total price. And that's where it comes into more of these, like, more fluid discussions of, okay, we want to try converting our app to iPad. do I want to spend the probably 5 hours scoping out that project and telling you it's going to cost you this much money? Or do you want to just let me, as a client, run with it and deliver all of these things that will be helpful to you slowly over time? And, you know, you're just going to pay me the same price per month. And, like, you know, you'll eventually get this feature complete app, but you're not going to have to pay upfront for it. You're not going to have to pay an unknown amount because it's hourly. You're paying that same rate per month, and you, you know, you can track the progress on your own. And that's really where the it becomes less of a science and more of an art. Like, how do you propose these opportunities to someone as, this is a really huge ask, but maybe it doesn't require as much work for me. This is a really small ask, but it requires a lot more work, and making sure that those even out in the long run. Like, some months I'll only do half of the time that I had expected, and other months will be double because they have like a really crazy bug fix. And that's the risk in the game that you play with a flat rate, and making sure that it evens out for you to be happy and your client to be, you know, feel like they're getting the right value from what they're paying you.
Okay. Yeah. To me, that's not much different from like hiring a developer at a monthly salary, and you work on the project over time, and maybe it takes 3 months or maybe it takes 6 months or whatever. I spent a lot of time in my own freelancing career trying to make the value-based pricing thing worked. And I had this awful experience. It was like 2012. I was working for this client, and I had read some of Alan Weiss's work. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he has this book called Value-Based Fees is what it's called. And then, so I had read not that particular book, but his other book, $1 Million Consulting, where he also talks about value-based pricing. And it made a lot of sense to me, because the idea with that is that you charge based on what the work is worth rather than how long it takes you. Because really, how long it takes is irrelevant. It's really all about what it's worth to the client. And so I tried to do this, but I tried to do it in a really naive way, which is my client would give me like a list of features he wanted, and then I would individually value price each one of those things. And so I'd say, like, this will be $500, this will be $1,500, blah, blah, blah. And then he would, like, he always said okay to all of it. But it, like, it was so exhausting to, like, have to come up with an individual price for each feature. And later I realized that what I was doing was just, like, so crazy and stupid, frankly. And it was just so like draining for both of us. And so I did that actually one other time. Besides that, I somehow didn't learn my lesson, but then I realized like what a bad idea that was. And so then I realized that that's probably not the way to do it. And then I tried to do it more on a macro level. Like, I had a client who I had a bigger project for, and I charged him, you know, it was like a small, like $5,000 project or something. I don't know how long it took me, but that went pretty well. And it was super nice to not like worry about tracking hours or something like that as I was working on it. Then I delivered it. But then we got into the maintenance mode where the initial project had been delivered. It was working, but now we just needed like little tweaks. And sometimes it would just be, he would need something that would take 30 minutes, and then maybe the next month he would need like an hour's worth of stuff. And so it was kind of back to the same place of like, okay, how do I like value price these individual things? That doesn't make sense. And so that didn't work out that great either. What I eventually came to realize is that, in my opinion, value-based pricing with software development really doesn't work because of the nature of software development. For one, the work done is usually really distant from the value that's created. So like, if somebody is a marketing consultant, it's really easy to imagine that like you could do a project for somebody that would have the expectation of increasing the conversion rate on a certain sales page or something like that. And so that's really close to the value. But like, if you change some behavior of an application, then that's really distant from the value that's created. So what I realize is that if you want to do value-based pricing, you have to provide a different service. And one thing that I've found where value-based pricing does work is with training. And that was really interesting when I got into that. So when I used to do training, I would like fly around to various client office locations and do like a 3-day or 5-day. I did one that was 5 weeks. Oof. But that was great because you can charge really good prices for that. And it doesn't have a lot of the headaches that come with software development. Because you kind of just, you make the agreement, then you fly to the location, teach the class, fly away, and you're done. Anyway, tell me about your experiences with the coaching stuff. How do you do that, and what portion of your work is that kind of stuff and all that?
Yeah, it's a really good point about value-based, like coaching, mentoring, whatever you want to call it, training is a little bit easier to sell than value-based for projects or development. So my coaching business is mostly one-on-one with individuals. And we do, like I said, like pair programming through Tuple. So just like a, you know, really good pair programming native app. And we do like 2-hour sessions, and we always work in their code base. So the idea there is that like they have an iOS app or a Rails app that they like can't get over the hump of something, or have never written tests in their life and they are getting worried that they need to add tests. And we'll just work on their app together as if we were employees for the same company, you know, so to speak. I spent a couple of years at Pivotal Labs doing like TDD and pair programming 8 hours a day, like XP. So very familiar with all of those techniques and, you know, that kind of stuff. And slowly moving into getting larger companies to say like, okay, this team needs some training. Can you help us with the same techniques, like pair programming individuals and then like GitHub pull request reviews?
Wait, sorry, there's something I missed. So You said you were working at Pivotal. By the way, which were you on site with Pivotal or remote?
I was on site with Pivotal when they were still Pivotal Labs before the VMware acquisition, before all the stuff that's going on now.
Okay. What location?
In New York.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I happened to visit the San Francisco Pivotal Labs office. Nice. for some reason once. Okay, you said you were working at Pivotal Labs, and then I didn't understand the transition to the next thing you were doing.
Yeah.
Was that at a different or was that at Pivotal Labs, or how did that work?
Career-wise, it went Pivotal Labs, then the startup for a couple of years.
Got it.
But the techniques that I picked up at Pivotal Labs, I carried over to the startup and is what I've been using. I've been really applying in these training sessions. It's essentially like we're Pivotal Labs employees working on your code base, ping-ponging back and forth, the keyboard control, you know, you write a test, I make it pass, I write the next test, you make it pass type stuff. And really getting in, you know, getting in deep to the code base to make sure that they get value, not only from what they're learning, but it's not abstract. It's concrete because they're like, oh, I remember now how to do, for example, polymorphism, because it was this model in my own object, in my own app. It's like, it sticks so much better and it resonates so much more. And it's so much easier for people to grasp concepts than like a generic, here's how polymorphism works. Pretend you have 2 bags, you know, and one's a cat, one stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay.
So most of that business, like I said, is individuals. I'm moving into more larger companies. Percentage wise, it's probably like, I don't know, maybe 20%, 15% of my business right now, if I had to give a rough estimate. I don't know if that's going to go up or down in the new year, but right now it feels like a really good balance because pairing sessions are still very draining, even for someone who's experienced.
Yeah. Tell me about it. I used to work for this organization, I guess they're kind of well known now, Andela, and I would do a couple of hours of pair programming each morning. And by the end of it, it was just so exhausting, even though I really enjoyed it. I liked it a lot. It just takes so much attention and thought for a sustained period. I tried to do the freelance pair programming thing for a while, but like I never like this was before I this is before I had some level of like internet fame that I do now, if I do. And I could never find people to pair with. Like there was, you know, if I tweeted to my 300 followers, hey, I'm going to do some pair, like nobody would take me up on it, you know? So how do you find people to pair with?
Yeah, it's usually inbound leads. Like I mention it on my website. I mention it on Twitter every now and then, and someone will reach out to me via email and be like, hey, you know, I'm looking for help with this project or whatever. I have this, you know, these hours open. Are you open to doing some sort of training? And it's always paid. You know, it's part of my business. It's not just me giving back or anything. It's like, it's a paid program. I have a bunch of different tiers for it. And I also am very like tuned into a couple different specific Slack groups. So there's one that's like for ex-Pivotal Lab employees. And they're always like, that's a really good lead gen, because they're like, hey, I need help with this project. And I'm like, oh, I do Pivotal Lab style work. Like, you know, come work with me or bring your company here. And some of it is still now, or is even now, word of mouth, which is super exciting. That one of my past, like person that I was mentoring for like 6 months, they referred me to someone who I'm working with now, which is really cool.
That's great. That's like the ultimate compliment when somebody refers you to somebody else. Is this mostly like individuals paying out of their own pocket, or like companies hiring you to do this, or what?
It's mostly individuals, and I'm trying to move away from that into more companies, because like to make it viable for me, I have to charge a pretty solid rate for it. Cause like, not only is it, I'm spending those hours 100% dedicated to you, but it's also very draining. So I need to, like, there's a lot of, you know, cool down time and warm up time. So I'm trying to move towards companies that will understand, as you talked about, more of the value pricing of training than like an individual paying out of their pocket. That said, I have had a lot of individuals use their, I forget what it's called, like their tech stipend or their professional development stipend on me with training, which works out really well because the company doesn't, like, technically is paying, but the, you know, the student is able to do it how they see fit.
Yeah, that part's tough. That's the exact challenge that I've had in more recent years, because, well, now that I have a job, I don't do any kind of, I don't do any outside work outside of my job. Mm-hmm. But people would email me and ask for, this is actually how my current job started. People would email me and ask me if we could spend some time programming together, if I could help them. But they couldn't afford the rate that would be justifiable to me in order to make it work. And it's funny, I got an email, this would have been late 2018. This guy was like, hey, I was trying to follow your AWS Rails tutorial, and I was having kind of a tough time with it. I'm actually a doctor, and I'm teaching myself how to code. Do you think you could like help me with this? And I emailed him back, and I'm like, well, this kind of thing usually doesn't work out. So like, you know, no thanks or whatever. And then he emailed me back, and he's like, come on, let's just like have a phone call and see like what's what and blah, blah, blah. And so I had a call with him, and then we ended up, the original plan was that I would kind of hold his hand and he would do the work himself, because he wanted to build a software system for his medical clinic. But then like he, frankly, I think he was expecting me to be fairly incompetent based on the experience he had with the two programmers that he tried to use before me. But then I did some work and he was happy with it. And he's like, actually, don't teach me. Let's just have you do it. And so then we did a small project and we did a bigger project. And now 2.5 years later, we're still working together, and we'll probably work together for the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
Which it's kind of funny, but he and I have actually talked about that. Like, we expect to work together for the next forever. Anyway, how did we get there? Oh yeah. People reaching out, and there's like that gap between what's justifiable for an individual to pay out of their own pocket versus what's justifiable for somebody like you and me to charge. Yeah. It's great to be able to sell services to people who aren't paying with their own personal money. I've tried to figure that it's tough, cause I've done the, would you happen to have ever done any training gigs? Like, not just one-on-one, but like for a team of people?
Nothing more than I work with a team, but I train individuals this with the same thing, like through Tuple, through digital, whatever. I've never gone to a company and like taught a group or anything.
Got it. Yeah, I did that for a while. And the interesting thing was it's super easy to get those gigs through training companies. And, you know, if you, Joe, are interested in, well, they don't do this anymore because of COVID, but maybe they'll start doing it again soon. But if you just Google like training company or like start plugging in the technologies, you know, like Ruby on Rails training company, blah, blah, blah. You just go to their website and like you basically apply and you go through this like vetting process. And as long as they like you, then they'll like put you on their list of trainers. And when they get requests from their clients, they'll be like, hey, Joe, do you want to go to Amsterdam next month and teach a class on JavaScript? And you'll be like, okay, I guess I'll do that. And that's great. But those training companies take a huge bite out of the fee. And the thing that I could never quite pull off, aside from one single client, is how to get those direct gigs so you're not getting the cut. And what I determined is that you pretty much have to be like, you have to have a reputation, and you have to have like a way to attract those clients to you. So like somebody who's written a book or has a strong online presence or whatever.
Mm-hmm. My master plan with that is to work with an individual at a company and have them refer me to their company. That's how I got the first like company gig. Like I was working with someone individually. We did a few sessions together and he was like, this is great. I love it. I need you to teach the rest of my team. He brought it to his boss. Then they were able to hire me to help out with like all three of their developers on the iOS side. And I'm still working with them, which is pretty cool. And that was able to get me like my foot in the door and able to charge rates that are more comparable to like being more value, you know, being more possible to scale for my time than just doing working with individuals. And that's really important when it's going to be, you know, a big part of my business versus just trying something out for fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great when that's possible, because like the one to many is much more valuable than just the one to one. Yeah. Okay. So to finally get around to what we were originally going to talk about, we wanted to get to Mugshot Bot a little bit. And I've like noticed Mugshot Bot because I've seen people. Okay. So like an internet friend of mine who's been on the podcast also, Axel Key, I know he uses Mugshot Bot. I think that's primarily on his tweets or when I've seen that. And it's on my long to-do list to get it set up for my own site. But tell us about what Mugshot Bot is and all that.
Yeah. So I blog. I try to write every Thursday for 3 hours. That's like my cadence. If I publish, I publish. And I always get to the point where I'm like, I finished copy editing and I'm like ready to hit, you know, git push effectively. And I'm like, ah, crap, I have to make one of those stupid social images for Twitter and stuff. And it just like, it always nagged me way more than it should. So I would like go into Figma or like use Pablo or something and like create some generic background image with an unsplash and then like some, you know, fancy text on top. And they just never resonated with me. And they always took way too long to like perfect it. So Mugshot Bot just automates all of that. You drop in a URL as your like OG image tag. You just point it directly to Mugshot Bot servers. And when Twitter or Facebook goes to display your preview underneath a link, it will fetch your page and grab content from it and then create an image based on that content and then return it to Facebook or Twitter for the preview. So you don't ever have to think about it. You can configure it on the website to like be yellow with like a blue background or, you know, this font or whatever, or this, you know, custom image. Or you can just do that all through the URL string, which is pretty cool. So there's like a bunch of parameters you can pass in. Or you can set it as meta content on your actual page. So you set it up once, you have it pull the content of that page via the service, and you just have images for every single page on your either blog or your content site or your community site has been really effective. And I definitely built it out of a need for myself. But yeah, it's really cool to start to like be scrolling through Twitter and see someone else like Axel their mugshot bot image come up when they paste a link to their, you know, back to their blog or whatever.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's like you created this, it sounds like, out of a scratch your own itch kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, side note, I've always thought the like scratch your own itch advice was like highly dubious advice, because when it works, it can work great. But it's also how we end up with like 8,000 bug tracking apps, because developers scratch their own itch in that way. So like, you have to scratch your own itch in an intelligent way if you're going to do that. And it has to be an itch that not only you have, but other people have too. And obviously this, you know, this what do you call it? Twitter card preview, and for mm-hmm. other social media too. That is certainly like, I wouldn't call it the hugest pain point in the world, but I have a small amount of frustration. I think you even noticed a particular one of my tweets where I like complained about how my preview image was not very good. Mm-hmm. There's a small amount of frustration every time I post something and like the preview doesn't look that good. Yeah. So it seems pretty compelling. What has the adoption of the product been like?
Yeah. So I launched, I actually don't even remember. I have like a whole timeline on my blog of like, here's my idea. And then in like 29 or 30 days, I actually got my first paying customer, which was like the quickest I've ever turned around any sort of side project. I think it was like October or something. But as of now, I think there's like 20 or so paying customers, maybe 25. And that's either like the annual plan or the monthly plan. It's like just covering Heroku costs right now, which is always like a really cool milestone to hit. It's not making me like a ton of money, but it isn't losing money, which is really cool because I can kind of let it sit and not worry about eating into my, you know, hard-earned other money. But yeah, it's been hard to communicate the value to people. Like people are like, oh yeah, social images are like easy. I just create them once and like then I'm done for every blog post. And I agree with that. And it's more for people that are just like, that blog almost every week and like don't want to deal with it, or blog every month and like forget about it, or a blog that doesn't have any of these, that's using the generic image for everything and like want to change their whole website in like 20 minutes, like custom image for every blog page on their site in like one setup. And those are the type of people that I've been trying to reach out to, because they definitely convert the highest. But yeah, it's not my like 100% focus, because it's only bringing in very little money and it's hard to justify.
And how long has it been out there, just roughly?
Yeah. So I think I launched it in like October.
Okay. So it's barely been out for any time yet.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. That's super October, interesting. Yeah. I wonder if having it out there year after year would do something for its adoption. Obviously, the more time it's out there, the more chance it has to get well known by people. Because, mm-hmm. like, you know, it's kind of funny, like, even for somebody like me, who I'm like, yeah, that's obviously a good idea. Yes, I want to use that. But no, I haven't actually signed up for it yet. Mm-hmm. It's hard, even beyond like convincing somebody it's a good idea and convincing somebody to want it, there's still the friction of actually having to do that little bit of work to get it set up. But that seems probably right, that like for somebody who's like somebody like me, who like I'm a fairly prolific blogger and I don't want to necessarily have to put a lot of effort into that like overhead stuff for each blog. Like I want to focus on the blog content and I don't want to focus on a bunch of manual work to like create it. And plus, I'm really not the kind of person who like, I really have a distaste for like this trend online where you land on a blog post and like 90% of the viewport is taken up by some picture of trees or something. And it's like, no, I just want to like read the thing.
Thanks, Medium.
Yeah. And before I said that, I made sure to go to one of your blog posts and see, you know, before I criticize that style. But yours is a nice, clean style where, you know, it's just the way it should be. It's like the heading and then the text, which, and I get compliments sometimes on my site, which is like people mention that it's clean. And I appreciate those compliments because that's exactly what I'm going for. Like, there are, well, I don't know when you first started using the internet, but I started using the internet in like 96. And mm-hmm. so like, it was much simpler back then. And oh, yeah. part of me like yearns for that simpler internet. When did you first start using the internet?
Well, I can say that I was on AIM when you had to use a dial-up connection on AOL. And like, you know, when, what was the first? Napster, I guess, was still like the illegal downloading, you know, music thing. Like that was when mm-hmm. I got started on the internet. I was like, you know, downloading songs from Napster and burning them to mini discs. So whatever time frame that was, if anyone can, you know, put that on a timeline for me in my parents' basement, right?
Yeah, it sounds like late 90s or so.
Probably something like that, yeah. But when I actually got started, like, contributing to the internet probably wasn't until, you know, when I was at Pivotal, so like 2005, 2006, I'd say. And by then, like, that was, I guess, Web 2.0 time, when Web 2.0 was kind of becoming fun and exciting. So I feel like I never, the nostalgic for me of the good old days of the internet isn't really a thing because I didn't care back then. It was just like the internet wasn't a place for me to do business. It wasn't a place for me to do anything but chat with my friends and download music until I really started to contribute back and you know, work at Pivotal and all that stuff. So I don't know. This is kind of a ramble of me going down, you know.
Well, I kind of dragged us down this rabbit hole myself. Yeah. By the way, one of the web trends that I absolutely hated that I'm so glad that seems to have passed is mm-hmm. carousels. There was time, maybe like in the early 2010s, it seemed like every website had a carousel, and it's like it shows some image, and then, or like what's worst is when there's like an image with text on it and you start reading it and like you're halfway through the sentence and it swipes and now you have a new carousel thing.
I mean, that parallax is great. Like,
oh just, yeah, like, I remember that.
Like I have the top of the line MacBook Pro 16 inch that you can buy, completely maxed out from, you know, before the announcement last week. And store.apple.com is laggy on my computer.
It's like, oh wow.
What? And I'm using Safari. It's like, come on, Apple. Why are you using so much parallax on these product pages that I can't even scroll smoothly with your best machine? You know, it's like, it's sad. I really don't like these web trends that take over the user experience for what they think looks good.
Yeah, that's why I appreciate, like, if you've seen motherfuckingwebsite.com, where it's just like Times New Roman, and it's so great. And then, like, Paul Graham's blog I really like because he appears not to have updated it since like 1998, which is great because it's just text on a screen, which is like, what more do you want? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so like I keep getting Mugshot Bot mixed up with this other product called Place Card Me. And so I want to call it Place Card Me. But obviously it's not that. This other guy, his name's Corey something. He like does kind of a open whatever. Yeah. He blogs about his entrepreneurial experiences and stuff. Anyway, so you built Mugshot Bot and you built it in Rails, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all Rails.
And how are you handling like the infrastructure part? Is it just on Heroku or?
Yeah, it's gone through a couple changes over the past couple months, especially recently. So it's hosted on Heroku. It's like, you know, two server instances and a background worker, nothing too exciting there. Pretty standard database and then some Redis stuff. What it used to do, so the biggest, most complicated part of Mugshot Bot is that it takes HTML rendered and then some, you know, markup with Tailwind CSS. That's how it's all styled. And then it shoves it through something and you get an image coming out. And that's what I serve over the wire. That gets uploaded to, you know, Active Storage and, you know, uploaded to AWS, all that good stuff. But that big black hole in the middle of the HTML to image converter, I've gone through like four different versions so far. And that's like where Mugshot Bot, I think, gets super interesting because I have a lot of experience that I don't know if I want anymore about how to render images from HTML. But other than that, it's like a pretty standard SaaS app. Like, it has pricing, it has like Stripe checkout, it has a sign-in through I'm using Clearance, like nothing too crazy, but the image generation has gone, like I said, many iterations. So it first started with just like, so you're familiar with WKHTML2PDF?
I don't think so. It sounds vaguely familiar.
It's like a super, it's new, but it uses like a very old version of WebKit to convert HTML to PDF documents. And it doesn't support, like, it barely supports grid. It doesn't support columns or anything. Like, you have to use Flex, or it doesn't support Flex. You have to use Float. So it's like really, really old. And I upgraded to Tailwind 2.0, and that uses a ton of new CSS properties. So that was just, it would not work anymore. So I ended up using something called Ferrum. Ferrum hosts a Chrome browser and wraps Puppeteer inside of your Heroku, or inside of your instance, and they have like a Heroku build pack. So you would call into Ferrum, hey Chrome, load this page, and then take a screenshot of it. And Chrome would spin up, render your content, take a screenshot, and then spit it back on the other end. And it worked beautifully. It took like half a second to render an image. I was like, this is great. And I deploy it. Slowly over the course of a day, the memory usage just like creeps up. Memory usage creeps up. Because these Chrome instances, you're spinning up a new instance of Chrome every time someone hits the website. Those are pretty chunky. Like, they require a lot of memory. And I'm sure I wasn't cleaning them up like perfectly. But having multiple requests come in at a second and have those all spin up their own instance of Chrome was just a nightmare. Like, I didn't want to deal with keeping one instance open and like a pool of them, blah, 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 blah. So I moved over, I punted on it, and I was like, the value of Mugshotbot isn't the actual image generation, it's the tooling around the image generation. So now I actually just make a network request to Browserless, which manages a farm of Chrome Puppeteer browsers that you can do whatever you want with. You pay by the second, and I send them the HTML and the embedded CSS. They generate an image for me, and then I save it. And it's like, it takes 2 seconds instead of half a second, so like my request cycles are pretty slow, but it just works so much better. I pay a little bit more money than I was before, and it's just a headache I don't have to deal with.
Oh, that's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, for that. So I've done all kinds of side projects over the years, and I know the feeling of like having to deal with some complicated technical issue, because it's like,
yeah,
I don't want to have to spend the time on this fiddly technical stuff, because the sales and marketing part is super hard anyway, and that's that's what like really matters, is the sales and marketing, because obviously doing the coding doesn't do anything, at least not directly, to grow the business. And so it's always so frustrating when your time is like stolen by those kinds of issues. So you went through like 4 different iterations of the image creation method.
Yeah, between the WK, the WebKit product, Ferrum, Browserless. I also just like tried hosting an instance of Chrome on my own and using Puppeteer directly. Like, so I had a Rails build pack and a Node build pack on Heroku, which just, I needed to be on the 1 gigabyte instance instead of the 0.5 gigabyte instance. And it's just like, it was all of this infrastructure that I don't want to manage, because I could figure it out if I wanted to. That's not what I want to figure out. And I don't want to have to learn all this when I enjoy writing Rails code and creating really fun apps and marketing these things. I don't want to have to deal with infrastructure more than I have to. So I punted on it and was like, Browserless it is. I pay them $10 every time I generate, you know, some thousand number of images, and it's good.
Yeah, that seems like a smart choice. Okay, let's see. Well, I've dragged us through a number of highly irrelevant topics, so I appreciate you coming with me on the journey to all these down all these rabbit holes.
It's been fun.
Yeah, before we wrap up, where can people go to find out more about you online and Mugshotbot and anything else that you want to share?
Yeah, so I blog on Maserati.com. My Twitter handle is Joe Maserati. My email is joe@maserati.com. So as long as you can spell my last name, you should be able to find me online. And yeah, if you're interested in Mugshotbot, DM me on Twitter. They're open, or just send me an email and I can give you a few months of pro for free and you can get it going, because I'm always looking for new people to see if it works for them. And yeah, excited if you're a fan of this podcast, happy to help out a little bit.
Awesome. Well, Joe, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was really fun.